What? Welcome to the Blue and Orange Nation Talking Mets podcast. This is Vinny with my co-host Mike. Hello, Mike. How are you today?
I'm doing good. Trying to stay cool.
Yes, it's a hot day. So it finally feels like summer is here, which is always a good thing. So, Mike, we have to talk about what is, as usual, another really strange time in Metville. This team never disappoints. It's funny, anybody out there who wants to do a Mets podcast, there's never a shortage of material with this team. I don't know what it's like if this was the Talking Brewers podcast, but as far as the Mets go, there is never a shortage of news on and off the field with this team. So we have a lot to talk about today, both on and off the field. And we'll be joined later on. We should be getting a call from Artie from Brooklyn. And you know, with everything that's going on these days, that should be fun. You probably should lower your volume when Artie joins. That's just my gut reaction here. But Mike, I guess the first thing we should start to talk about, you know, it's on a serious note, although it goes into one of those, you know, strange Met news things, is the news that just broke a little while ago about former Met Darrell Hamilton. Who apparently was killed as part of some kind of a murder-suicide with, I guess, a woman, a mother. I think he had a child with the woman. The details were a little bit sketchy when I read them earlier today. But pretty shocking, Mike. I mean, he's a young guy, 50 years old.
We've seen this a few other times. And it's tragedy. First took their own life. Well, taking lives, human lives being snuffed out. I don't know the details behind it. I don't know if the details are going to come out, but I can't think of any that makes the same type of sense.
No, again, it sounds like one of those senseless loss of lives that, you know, obviously not to take this into too much of a direction, but we read about it every day in other areas not to do with sports, that I guess it shouldn't come as a surprise that it creeps into sports. It's a pretty sad commentary on our society as a whole. But in terms of, you know, Metville, you know, Darrell Hamilton, while he didn't have a very long Met career, he added some important moments, 99, 2000 postseason. He was on MLB Network for a while. I mean, it's just a surprising thing. It's a sad thing. And what I was glad to see is immediately – the Mets put out some kind of a statement, obviously wishing their condolences to his family, but also noting that they're going to have a moment of silence in his honor when they get back to Citi Field on Friday, which is good. Although that moment of silence is going to be a joint moment of silence because the Mets lost another member of their family when former co-owner Nelson Doubleday passed away the other day. And we could talk about Nelson Doubleday. I think we'll talk about him later in the show. You know, sometimes, you know, Met owners are not generally the Steinbrenner type owners or even Marge Schott owners that get a lot of press and a lot of, you know, either infamy one way or the other. Nelson Doubleday wasn't one of those kind of guys, but he did have a couple of key moments, such as, you know, the narrative goes that he was the voice behind getting Mike Piazza to the team. And if you take that into account, you know, Nelson Doubleday is one of the most important figures in the late 90s, early 2000s Mets history, because without Piazza, that team would be nowhere, Mike.
Yeah, that was a signature moment. There are many others, actually. I have further thoughts about Nelson. And as you said, I think we'll make sure we leave time in the show to give a little bit of a full tribute to Nelson and talk a little bit about him at this time of his passing. As far as Hamilton, I don't have, you know, it just happened. The only thing I can say about it is that, you know, just, you know, we know there was other shootings that have nothing to do with sports that have been in the news. for a week now, and just all this stuff is just depressing. It's going to work.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you don't want to think about it. You want to go to sports for your escape from that stuff, and then it creeps into sport too. There's no safe haven to get away from the bad news that's out there. I was going to segue, Mike, by saying let's move on to some better news. But the next thing I was going to talk about is about the Mets' visit to Atlanta. And while it's not life and death, and I'm not comparing it to that, it certainly wasn't great news. You know, look, even on the best of times, the Mets struggle at Turner Field. This was a year that the Braves were, you know, down, rebuilding. The Mets were flying high, first-place team. You would think that this year it would be different if it was ever going to be different. And what was really funny, although not ha-ha funny, was I think it was Thursday or early Friday, our good friend Adam Rubin tweeted out the pitching matchups, that it was DeGrom, Syndergaard, and Harvey were the three pitchers. And he put at the end of his tweet, looks like a sweep. Little did we know he was right, but he had the broom was on the other hand. With those three guys going, with the Braves kind of a, you know, second division type team this year, to get swept is just painful. But add to it, Mike, the way that they got swept, it was just awful. I think we could go through every game if we wanted to. I don't know if I have the stomach for it, frankly. But it's pretty well encompassed with yesterday. Yesterday, you know, Harvey pitched great. Only gave up one run, and that was on his 115th pitch that Terry left him in when he probably was a little bit out of gas. But, you know, 2 days before, he took out DeGrom at 97 pitches, I believe, and the bullpen blew it. So he didn't want to get burned that way twice. He left Harvey in, gave up the one run, as if that's a sin to give up one run. But the Mets then get first and second in the ninth inning with no outs. Now, I looked on one of the, you know, Baseball Prospectus, one of the places that has the run expectancy chart, right? First and second, no outs. A team is expected to score 1.5 runs. And don't ask me about the half a run, okay? But, of course,
so we need
that half a run, when you round it up, we would have tied the game, right? But we didn't get that. We got Duda, who has cooled off considerably, but he's still the best hitter we have it right now. Flied out, and then Michael Kadaya. I will tell you this true story. Michael Kadaya came to the plate. I got up to go get a drink. My son said, what's Kadaya going to do? And I said, he's going to hand it to a double play. And unfortunately, I was right. But that's the way it goes. He went first and second, no outs. Run expectancy, 1.5. There should be an asterisk that says, unless it's the Mets, in which case, give me a break, they're never going to score. And that's what happened. But that just sums it up. There's nothing went right. We had our, you know, all of the warts showed in these three games, Mike. The offense was non-existent. The defense was brutal. And the bullpen didn't come through. And you wake up, you're out of first place. You got swept. You know, you kind of left a little stunned, Mike. What were your thoughts?
Well, you know, we've been saying, really, I think since we launched the podcast in October of 2014, that from where we sat, it appeared that the team had been assembled to can't hit, can't field. And, you know, this team can't hit, can't field. It's not, you know, there's no surprises. We haven't been pleasantly surprised by something that we didn't understand, that the front office understood that we didn't understand. And it was on display. I mean, the series to me was so representative of the season. You had, you know, Syndergaard was a little spotty, but honestly was let down by his defense. Then
yeah, that was a weird game, Mike.
The DeGrom game was just flat out, like, you know, forget about the hitting. If somebody just catches the ball, they win that game. And then the Harvey game was, you know, okay, let's also remember we can't hit. You know, let's throw that too. So it was all on display.
You know, Mike, you talked about the game with Syndergaard, which, you know, I guess he didn't even make it five innings, if I recall. I don't have the statistics in front of me. But that was a weird game if you watch it. It wasn't one of those that you look at the box score and you really understood what happened because, you know, watching the game, Syndergaard did not get rocked, okay? There were infield hits. That was the game that, what's his name, A.J. Pruszynski had four hits, right, or three, and, like, one of them was hit hard. A dribbler down the line, another one that barely got down the line. You know, there were infield hits. That was the game with the bunt play, right, that we didn't get anybody. A run scored. I remember there was a run. They scored two runs one inning, the Braves, and the only ball that got out of the infield was the sacrifice fly. It was just a bizarre game, but again, it's a defense.
I have to tell you that the games were running together because they were a little bit the Syndergaard game to me, the DeGrom game were very similar defensively. Because I don't remember which game it was. If you remember, I think it was definitely the Syndergaard game when nobody covered second base and somebody stole and they threw the ball to center field because the second baseman and the shortstop just stood there. You know, we saw stuff this weekend that's just like they're not just bad defensively; they're atrocious. I mean, you know, you walk the bases loaded, so you have a force at the plate, and then Campbell doesn't throw home. I can't even comprehend, you know, like how could that happen?
I was
not my son's little league coach. The guy that was, I'm telling you, if they had pulled that, oh man, I wouldn't want to be the little kids when they would have come in at the end of the inning. These are supposed to be major leaguers. Like they keep saying, the problem is we have quad A players. I think that's an insult to quad A players across America. Eric Campbell is an insult to call him a quad A player. If I'm a real quad A player, I'm like, wait, I can, you know, I'm a little better in AAA. This guy doesn't even know what he's doing. It was rough to watch.
Now, look, Mike, this begs the question, okay? And this flashed through my mind when I watched the game and I saw those kinds of mistakes. Is it on Sandy for putting together a team of guys who are not real ball players, or is it on the manager and the coaching staff? You know, shouldn't there be some accountability, you know, regardless of the fact that Eric Campbell is Eric Campbell, okay? There's a major league manager in that dugout who's probably been in the game for 30-something years. He doesn't prepare his guys to know that they throw home on that play? You know, at what point is this a managerial problem? Is it a player problem? Is it both? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think it's – we know there's a player problem, so we can start there. Whether there's a managerial problem on top of the player problem is a question that is worth asking. I've said many times when it comes to Terry that I think the most important thing a manager does is not, you know, the strategic type of moves. It's having the guys ready to play, and these guys are doing things to show that they're just not ready to play. Now, again, I'm not the clubhouse and all that. And we know that the people that we've interviewed that are in the clubhouse do tend to defend Terry. But the biggest thing I would say against Collins, and I understand how unfair it is, but life is not fair, is that he's the first manager in this team's history that goes all the way back to 1962 that's already managed four complete losing seasons without being relieved of his duties. At some point, you've got to just try, you know, you've got to say, wait a minute, you know, if he's not the problem, he's certainly not the solution. You know, this is a chemistry experiment thing. There's only so many things you could do. And one of the things we know that you can do, and it might be nonsense and it might accomplish nothing, but, you know, I don't want to sound terrible. The only one that's affected, if it doesn't work out, is Terry Collins. You know, one of the things you can do is change your manager.
No, and this goes back to you and I had an offline conversation just today about what I'm going to say now. This, it's one of the things that I think is bizarre in trying to really read what the heck is going on with the Mets, because the Mets have an inexpensive way of getting the fan base excited right in front of them. If they fired Terry Collins and hired Wally Backman tomorrow, the fan base will give them a honeymoon period of at least a couple months where they'll be fired up, they'll be happy about what they do, you know, Wally Ball, all this stuff, right? And they'll probably have a little bit, most teams when they change managers get a little bit of a spurt out of it, right? So even if it's not long term, it would kind of do a little bit of misdirection, help with the box office, don't have to spend money, which you would think, based on the narrative that the Mets have no money to spend, is something that they would be dying to pull the trigger on, right? Wouldn't that fit the general consensus of what's going on with the Mets and the kind of move that they'd want to make? Yet, we also know that Sandy is a guy who believes managers should do a certain thing and be kind of company men and execute the plan and all that stuff. So even though the narrative is they're cheap, they should do whatever move is going to placate the fan base, you know, without having to spend any money, they don't do that. They're following the Sandy plan of let's keep the manager that we like. This guy's a loose cannon. He's not a manager Sandy could control. So it just leaves you scratching your head saying, okay, so what is the problem? Is the problem money? Is the problem Sandy? What is the problem? And you, Mike,
well,
have...
When it comes to the manager, yeah. I have a hard time putting on Wilpon. So we know that I, in general, don't have a hard time getting on a Wilpon's case about anything. But what we know about Collins is, one thing we do know about Collins is that, in general, when you look at managers, he works cheap. However, we know Backman would work really cheap. I also find it very hard to believe that Jeff Wilpon wouldn't be happy to be able to, you know, be standing off on the side at a Wally Backman becomes the next manager press conference. So whether Backman is the answer or is not the answer, or if there is an answer right now, I definitely think that the reason that Collins is still standing is on all this end. It's not a Wilpon related thing.
I would just think, and I agree with you, Mike, I would just think that the Wilpons would be pushing for that move because it gives them some cover and some good press without having to spend a nickel. When I say spend a nickel, obviously you'd be paying the rest of Collins' salary, but that's less than close to.
I agree 100%. I would think that, correct, not only would they not stand in the way of that move, that would be a move that they would be, you know, they would embrace right now. They're trying to sell tickets, and people are getting very disenfranchised from the franchise again.
Yeah.
And it would create some, like we said, some short-term juice, some short-term headlines. And it might be all nonsense. I understand that. But, you know, baseball is a business, and they're the owners. And from their perspective, I would think that the last thing they want is the narrative to become very quickly, here we go again, this team's going nowhere. I mean, there's still a lot of tickets to sell. Now, Sandy, on the other hand, to give you motives, you know, if you take Collins out of here and you replace him with anybody, not just Backman, any other human being on this planet, and this team continues to go down into the toilet, Sandy has been treated very gently by the media and the fans, as far as I'm concerned. Everything's either the Wilpon's fault or Collins' fault. But you eliminate one of his shields if Collins is eliminated.
Hey, look, Mike, I think in this 5 minutes that we've discussed this, the more and more I think that this is going to happen, and you may disagree with me pretty strongly, but I think, you know, there's a perception that this year could have been the year. Although, you know, it's so funny. I don't remember which beat writer, one of the beat writers, had an article last week that said some Met insider says they're targeting 2016. And that was one of the most frustrating things I have read because I see no difference between 2016 and 2015. We're not waiting for anything, okay?
I don't see any difference between 2014 and 2015.
Right. Well, look, I guess the argument could have – I agree with you, but the argument could have been Matt Harvey.
Right, but there's always going to be somebody that's going to get injured.
Right. So look, so if they're afraid that if this spirals out of control over the next few weeks, that they don't get the nice bump in ticket sales that they should have gotten from the beginning of the year and the momentum heading into next year's season tickets and all that jazz, and if they don't want to spend money or prospects to actually improve the team, I would think that the drum should start to be beating louder from the Wilpon to say, Sandy, we have to do something to stop the negativity and at least sell tickets. We got to pull the trigger on Backman. I mean, what else could – look, if they're not going to make a trade a prospect or spend money, take on salary, their choices are Backman or, you know, Michael Conforto. And look, let's face it, the average fan – is not going to be that juiced up about Michael. Me and you are going to be juiced up, but is Michael Conforto going to really get people to go out to the stadium that other than his debut? Probably not. But there'll be a little bit of a buzz around Backman. At least in the media, it may stop the negative perception for a little while. And so if they're running out of levers to pull, maybe that one happens, Mike. I know that you and I hadn't talked about it before tonight. But the more we talk about it, the more I think it's a possibility.
I've never felt Collins even close to being on thin ice, meaning from the time he was hired up until sometime this year. I do think, just watching the press conferences during the Atlanta series, and even the last couple of weeks, right before our last podcast, was that whole strange six-man, five-man, oh, the press is making fun of me, back to five-man, back to six-man, G's in the rotation, but it's not really six, he doesn't count. Oh, we're going to shore up the defense, oh, but Flores is still playing shortstop. And the explanation sometimes from Collins has come with, I'm not moving Flores because you guys are going to make a big deal out of it, or I'm not doing this because I'm moving off the six-man rotation because you guys are making a big deal out of it. But first of all, it's funny, having, you know, lived here my whole life. I think that for a New York team, if these guys think they're really getting, like, hyper-scrutinized, I don't know what this, you know, they could show that they're just not really from around here.
Right.
Because I think they've been – I don't think the Mets have really been hyper-scrutinized these last 5 years. Unfortunately, more people checked out, you know, than anything
else.
Even in the media. Even in the media. I mean, it's not like they're getting blasted on a daily basis. But I think that he's feeling heat somewhere, Terry, and you can see it. So I do think that there's a chance that, yes, he – it's a logical move. I don't know Collins from a hole in the wall. You know, never met the man. From what I've seen of him, he seems like a good, decent man, a baseball lifer. I don't think he's, you know, this has got to be pretty much his last chance to manage a baseball team. He's kind of had, you know, this deck just against him the whole way as far as having real success. When you look at the rosters he's had to manage, that's just the way it went down. And that happens to managers when we can look through history. I mean, a lot of managers... That's life, you know. You get your four or five years if you don't pull it off. You try another manager because it on the small chance it works. Look,
right.
Willie Randolph was doing nothing with the Mets, and they switched to Manuel, and I understand that they collapsed at the end of the season. But go look at the record when Randolph was let go versus the record under Manuel that year. The difference is dramatic.
Right. But by the way, you mentioned
dramatic.
Manuel and Randolph. Manuel and Randolph, and I want to say, you know, I think Terry Collins would fit that mold of once he left the Met job, he gets no other job. It's like the Mets job, if you can't manage the Mets, if you fail with the Mets, you don't get a chance anywhere else. It's kind of funny because these guys complain. You know, Willie Randolph, he got his plaque at Yankee Stadium, which, again, if we were doing a Yankee podcast, you could laugh about how absurd that is. But he, you know, made some comment about people saying he got a raw deal. Let me ask you this question, Willie. If you got such a raw deal with the Mets, Why didn't somebody jump up and give you another managing job? If you're such a great manager, 29 other teams passed on you too, didn't give you the time of day. What does that tell you?
Well, I got to pile on a little bit with Randolph because I was really hurt when I saw that too, because I didn't see any reason for him to go after the Mets on a day where he was being honored for his playing career with the Yankees, right? It wasn't necessary. And he's got no right. He was interviewed by like 21 teams before the Mets hired him, and they all look he was. I think that Terry Collins managed those teams that Randolph had, and this is a man that I'm saying is fighting for his job, I really do believe he would have saw more than one postseason, and we also would have went to a World Series. I was never impressed for one second. When I rank managers, Willie Randolph is like right there with Salty Parker for this.
All right, so now let's move on for a minute about Collins. Although I say I'm going to move on, but I just want to give you one quick revision. I think that the Mets being what they are to us, Mike, here's what's really going to happen. They're going to fire Collins, but they're going to hire Bob Guerin. And it's like, you know, what did you do? Like, the whole let's fire the manager, we have an easy answer, here's something that'll fire up the fan base, blah, blah, blah. They'll mess it up. That's the Mets. The obvious move would be Backman. They'll go to Guerin. And it'll be a waste of time.
That would be my – look, you're going to ask me my prediction. That would also be my prediction. That'll be the normal – that'll be the compromise. The Wilpons will be pounding on Sandy that he has to do something. Collins will be in the crosshairs. They would want Backman marketing reasons. Sandy doesn't want any part of Backman because he might not do exactly what Sandy says every day. And right, the compromise would be Collins out, Guerin in. There's a change. There'll still be the press conference. They'll try to sell us Guerin. And that'll be a real tough sell. I mean, I'll give the man a chance because that's how life is, right? He'd be new. But I think we're all going to be very skeptical if that's how it goes down. And I'm with you. If Vegas is posting odds on all this, I would be betting on the Collins Guerin exacta over that Collins Bachman exacta every time.
But what's sad, Mike, is that I think we're both betting it because it would be a botched move. And we're counting on this brain trust to botch the move. I think that says it all right there. Let's move on. There's another thing that I think you and I have a little bit of a, you know, maybe a debate might be a strong word, but a discussion about, which is Juan Lagares. Now, you know Juan Lagares is one of my favorite players. But Juan Lagares has not been the player defensively so far this year that we've come to expect, the Gold Glover. And it's really been kind of twofold. He hasn't gotten to some balls that he got to last year. But a bigger problem is his arm is terrible, and it's come out in the past week that he has some elbow issues that could actually require Tommy John surgery, which is rare for a position player, but it does happen. So, you know, so that's sad to see because, as we know with pitchers, unless you're Masahiro Tanaka – and, you know, the pinstripes are enough to heal all wounds. You know, bad elbow ligaments don't heal. It's just going to be a problem until it just, you can't throw anymore, right? So if that's the case, if this is what Juan Lagares is going to be until he gets Tommy John surgery, I would argue, even though you hate to pull, you know, anybody who can hit at all out of the lineup, even though Lagares is by no means that much of a hitter, I think you just you cut bait right now with Lagares. You put him on the DL. You give him Tommy John surgery. You get somebody else to play center field because, you know, what are we really – he's not – if he the way he hits, if he's not a plus-plus center fielder, he's not worth it. And it gives us this false sense of what we have in center field if he can't do what he's supposed to do. And now I know you're going to say, what do? You can't play Siciliani, all that stuff. I hear all of that, Mike. But I just don't see what the point is of trotting Wanley Garris out there every day if he's not the player that we need him to be.
Well, I'm going to surprise you because I'm going to agree with you and also try to give a potential solution. So, first of all, you know, I've been harping with you a little bit, really all along, that you know something's wrong with this guy's arm. I mean, from April, I've been saying something's wrong with Legarris's arm, and he's just not the same guy. If he can't throw, think about how many assists he had last year. That was such a huge part of his game. And as you were saying, and I agree, I can't agree more. And I love Legarris, and I've been such a big proponent of the team on the glove alone. You know, when we talk about the glove, I use that terminology, but it really includes the arm. You know, I'm talking about his defense. And once he couldn't throw the way he used to be able to throw, he's not the same player. Now, then, what's happening now, and we saw it in the game the other day, was, you know, I heard Keith say when basically, you know, he botched a ball, Pazinski, of all people, was going first to third on a ball that was, you know, I mean, Legarris was going to pick up that ball in shallow center field now. He would have threw him out by 30 feet last year. And instead what happened was Legarris overran the ball because he tried to barehand it. Now, Keith's like, why is he trying to barehand the ball? And he shouldn't have been trying to barehand the ball. I'm not defending the move. Let's face it, we know why. Because he was rushing because he knows he can't throw.
Right.
He knows it himself. He knows he can't throw. He's hampered out there. And so I think we're also starting to see the fact that he can't throw affect his ability to catch the ball a little bit. You know, he's taking different routes. He's, you know, he's doing different things. I at least saw a ball that Kadaya caught the other day, and then, you know, the ball that Dano got run over on. That ball is caught by Legarris last year. He calls off Kadaya, okay? And B, throws a strike to the plate, and the guy's out by 10 feet. If he even goes.
Right. Last year's one, he would not go. You're right. Last year's Legarris, he does not go on that ball.
That's one of the funny things I find about it is, you know, and that's what Collins will get a bum rap sometimes with, like, the social media crowd is, you know, recently, within the last couple of weeks, you know, Collins talked about that he might need the TJ and the arm problems, and everybody said, you just told everybody, now the other team's know. I'm thinking, and I saw Ruben tweet it, and he's 100% right. He said, are you kidding me? What do you think, these teams don't have scouts? Like, they know. They knew by April 15th this guy wasn't throwing well. So I'm with you. If I was running the team, I would be biting the bullet. I would be trying to get this guy fixed so he's useful for us next year. We signed him to a contract extension because he's really not a plus player for this team. It's never been about the bat, right? If he can't throw, he's not the same guy. And I know we have a lot of holes and a lot of guys out, and I get it. But the move I'd be making is the move that this team never makes, and it could blow up in their face and be no good and not help, but it could also actually help. Which is, I would be bringing Conforto up today, tomorrow, after this show. I'd be installing him in left field. I say, the defense is going to be brutal without Legarris, no matter how we do this. I stick Grandison in the center field, and then I put Kadaira in right, who's probably going to be at least as good as Grandison. And maybe we would actually get a bat out of this. You got one hitter in this organization, and there'd be room for him. And, yeah, he might not be ready, but you know what? He might be ready. All around baseball, open your eyes. There's other teams that are promoting guys that are 21, 22 years old. The first on the scene is hit the hell out of the ball. David Wright was 21 years old. He came up, and all he did was hit. It's not. This guy looks like he can hit. This guy, I don't know why we don't bring this guy up at six.
Well, look, back to what we said about Collins. I do think there's a possibility that happens, Mike. Look, I think that they would like to not make it happen, and I think they'd like to stall a little bit. But I do think that if we are, you know, around the All-Star break, which is probably, about 2.5 weeks from now, whatever it is, 3 weeks from now, and we're still, quote-unquote, in it, you know, let's hypothetically say we're 2.5 games out of first, okay? And everything else is exactly the same as it is today. Conforto is batting about .380 in Double A. Lagares is, you know, with the bat and struggling defensively. Everything, you know, we didn't even talk about Dylan G, but we'll say they don't get to move Dylan G, so there's some financial constraints. You know, if you just pick up today and put it on July 15th, I think there is a possibility that it happens. You know, they'd get past the stupid Super 2 business and all that stuff. And
I think it's
the,
passed, by the way.
Yeah, I think it's like this week, if I remember correctly, but whatever.
Right.
I think there is a possibility, and I know it's very un-Sandy-like, but it goes back to this table pounding. You would have to think that the Wilpons, we can mock the Wilpons all we want, okay? But they've been in business for 30, 40 years, however long they're in business, and they have to make money or they wouldn't be in business. Forget the Ponzi schemes, all right? They have to at least know some business, forget investing. And they have to know from a business perspective that they can't let this fall apart and projecting that finishing around 500 will help season ticket sales for next year and blah, 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 blah. All the businessy stuff that they got to say, look, we got to pull some triggers here. And I think the Collins is a trigger. I think Conforto is a trigger. I mean, a Mats, I think, is definitely going to happen, although I don't know if that does that much. I know he should be an upgrade over John Neese, but how much better is our starting pitcher going to be? My God. Starting pitching is great. That's not the problem. You know,
right. Well, their problem with Mats, I agree with you, is – again, from the business side, if I'm the owner of the franchise, looking to sell tickets, and I've got that problem, I think we're at the stage where, like, it's not going to excite the fan base wants to bring another pitcher in here. I think it's almost like, it's not fair to Matt, it's not fair to Syndergaard or anybody, but it's like the common fan almost has, like, oh, another pitcher. You know, like, a hitter would really juice people up.
Right. No, the only way it works, Mike, and again, we're getting into creativity, and I know it's a broken record that we think one of Sandy's biggest problems is lack of creativity, but if they traded Bartolo Colon, used that money to get a position player, and brought up
right.
Mats to take his place, you know, then it all works, okay?
Right.
And, you know, maybe I'm not being fair because you don't see a ton of GMs pulling that off. But then again, a ton of GMs don't have guys like this ready to step in this unique circumstance that he has. And so to me, those are the kinds of things that, you know, makes Mats valuable. But otherwise, I agree with you. It's, you know, just swapping him for Nice. Yes, it's an upgrade, but nobody's going to get that excited. And frankly, it's not going to make that much of a difference on the field. It's going to make a little difference, but how many more wins? It's not that many. But Conforto could make a difference on the field, and I do think that can happen. I know that it's not likely, but I think every day that passes that we're in the same position we're in today, I think it's a possibility.
You got to turn a page at some point and say it's about winning at this stage, and you got to look at the situation and say, with Lagares in the condition he's in right now. When we play tomorrow, are we better off with Conforto in the lineup? Well, Lagares in the lineup, and we don't know what Conforto's going to do. But, like, listen, I'm not saying he's going to hit like he's hitting Double A. But can he out-hit Lagares? That might not be so hard for him to do.
I agree with you. I agree.
This team needs offense.
You're not kidding. They also could use some defense. But, you know, look,
I
want to
switch
to Dylan Z. But I want to just say one thing about defense, and you alluded to it in our Collins conversation. For a team who cannot field, two things amaze me. One is that we legitimately are waiting for the return of Daniel Murphy to the infield, that we think it might make things better. That's pretty crazy. And second of all, Terry Collins watches these games too, I presume, okay? How is he not tempted to put Tejada at short and Flores at third? How do you do this night after night? It's like it is almost insane. And I know that word is overused, But it's kind of insane. You have a shortstop, you're playing him at third, you have a third baseman, you're playing him at short, you're doing this night after night, and it fails, and the next night you write those same positions on the lineup card. What is going on? How could this happen?
I think they're doing it just to try to kill me or to test my blood pressure or whatever, and I joke with you about it, I think, earlier this week, that, you know, I guess that Gil Hodges wasn't innovative enough that he didn't used to play Harrelson at short, Harrelson at third and Garrett at short. Like,
he's new Maverick,
I don't understand what they're doing, you know? Right, he's new Maverick. But, you know, you just had me laughing because I was thinking, when you were talking about Murphy coming back and it could actually, you know, people say it would help the defense. I guess we're also figuring Murphy will come back and raise the baseball IQ.
I guess it's possible. When they said that they were hoping that Herrera would fill in for Murphy at second, maybe he thought filling in for Murphy means you don't cover second base on a throw. I can't believe this kid.
I think Murphy must be, like, while he's been out, has he been coaching these guys around the field, maybe?
We were going to talk about Dylan G, but I think it's time we go to Artie from Brooklyn. Artie is here, I know Artie's been watching these games, so I'm sure Artie has, if we have some pretty passionate things to say, I'm pretty sure Artie's got a ton to say. Artie from Brooklyn, you are on the Blue and Orange Nation Talking Mets podcast. Hello, Artie.
You know what's scary, Vin? You know what's scary, Mike? That when Murphy comes back, out of those three guys, Murphy's like a gold glove. I don't even know where we should put him because I'd want Murphy to play third, short, and second. So it's kind of like weird, you know? It's bad enough that we don't have the greatest lineup, okay? But if we're going to lose games 2-1, 1-0, okay, the least that Terry could do is go down with the damn ship. Not go down with a raft boat that has a freaking hole in it. All right? And putting Lefkowitz in there, whatever the hell his name is, and who hasn't pitched in 2 weeks and is not a lefty. You know, if you put Blevin in there, if you put Familia in there, I could live with it, I guess. Okay? But when you're putting guys like Torres for Harvey and Lefkowitz for DeGrom, Terry, you're killing me. You're absolutely killing me. Okay? And the thing is that you're going to win games, right? You can't win them defensively because you have a horrible team. They can't manufacture any runs. They can't bunt, okay? They can't hit and run. When was the last time we attempted a steal? When was the last time that we attempted a hit and run? The last hit and run was a mistake. Somebody, Terry, scratched his nose. And LeGarris accidentally hit it between first and second. I remember it. It was a guaranteed. It wasn't a situation for a hit and run, and they did it. That's the frustrating part. You know, and
no.
are we going to be waiting for David Wright? And then when are we going to make – Sandy has four chips in my mind, okay? He's got he's got Montero. He's got the catcher, okay? He's got those two guys for sure. And then he's got to be able to go and the Wilpons have to say, listen, Sandy, go after a bad contract and see if you can. They have to. That's the only way that they can make a trade. The Reyes thing fell. I mean, Toronto's in it now. Forget about Reyes and Batista. We have to get with somebody else.
You got it, Artie. Thank you very much. Hey, Mike, you know, Artie makes some good points. I think that, you know, he mentioned in his chips, he mentioned Kevin Plawecki. And Kevin Plawecki has filled in okay. I don't want to overstate how well he's done. But I just think that's a luxury this team can't have. I understand the catchers get hurt. Darno, he's hurt now. It's a precarious thing. But you can't have two starting catchers. You cannot have it, okay? They should be trading Plawecki, and you know what? If Darnold gets hurt, you have a backup catcher like every other team has, okay? Not every other team has okay? He's supposed to come up and be a star. It's not the way teams operate. So I think Plawecki has to be one of these guys that they have to look at as a chip that they should be looking to move. Whether or not Darnold comes right back or not. Artie mentioned Montero. I guess it's unfortunate that he's in, never, never land of his injury. We haven't heard anything about him for a while. But I do think he's a chip. And I do think that they, that's one of the frustrating things. And I feel it in Artie's voice, is they have chips to trade. It's not just, if you listen to Mike Francesa, he'll say everybody cost them Syndergaard. They're not going to trade Syndergaard. Well, that's not true. They can make other moves without trading Syndergaard, and they have all these other chips. And they have obviously have holes to fill. You would think that there's a match, some of these chips for some of those holes, Mike. Artie's not wrong.
I think they have, what we refer to as roster imbalance. We have so many starting pitchers that, let's talk about G a little bit. I mean, we designated for assignment the pitcher that, we as an organization thought was worthy of tendering a contract. And he's really been sort of shoved around all year. I still don't think he could be a back-end starter for someone. I don't know, because of his contract, maybe they can't get anything of any real value from him. We could be using him at the back end of our rotation, depending on what other moves we would have made. Between, in the last, 3 years we've seen this coming. I mean, we knew as an organization that we had all these pitchers in the pipeline for quite some time. We also knew that we had in our rotation G and Nice for a long time, right? These aren't, these things didn't just, appear out of thin air. And we also knew that there was no real hitting in the system at the higher levels. And we didn't even have any outfielders 2 years ago. It's been strange to me how there's been so little activity. You see, the Braves have made more moves as they rebuild since John Hart took over than the Mets have made since 2010. We just don't transact.
No, you're right. It's crazy. It really is crazy.
I want to address the financials just for a second about that, though, because that's a big factor. And it's not the only factor, and that's what frustrates me sometimes, that people act like it's everything. But it is a big factor. One, if you look at that trade the Braves made the other day, that was all about their owners being willing to take on Bronson Arroyo's $14 million contract right now. He's basically useless. And for taking that contract, they got the 16th pick in last year's draft. I mean, that's basically like, look, if you pay this guy, we'll give you a prospect. That's a nice trade. And just about any, I'm sure Sandy would make that trade. My point is, if he was allowed to do that, that's right up his alley, right? That's right up his alley. So it's not just Sandy, is what I'm saying. I discussed, and that's what's sort of frustrating about the whole thing, because we're right there, I discussed
there's one
Brewer guys. Yep.
Mike, there's one caveat, is that the Arizona front office is one of the only front offices that's worse than ours, because they obviously appear to be cheap, but they are also clueless, okay? And this is not the first time that we've scratched our heads on a trade that they've made.
But I do think money was a big factor there. Yeah.
Yes, I agree. But I also think they just don't know what the heck they're doing. But look, you're right. And Mike, but that's why you mentioned Dylan G. And Dylan G was, supposedly there was two things we heard about Dylan G. One is that a while ago, there was a possibility, and again, I don't know if this is true. It could be just floated out there by somebody, that we could have traded him for Juan Uribe, and we didn't want to do that.
Right.
Well, Juan Uribe looked in this series with the Braves that we just had. I sure as hell would rather have Juan Uribe at third base than Eric Campbell. Okay.
Right. That's right.
And so what's one thing that frustrates you? And then second is, you know, again, they put him on the DFAG. Supposedly there was some interest, but not enough to make the deal. If we are in Diamondbacks mode and we need to save every nickel, you're telling me none of this interest, people who called the Mets to make a deal, none of them were interested in paying even a portion. I'm not saying full, Mike, but if you could have saved half of it, $1.5 million of the three, and the Mets are looking to scrimp pennies to make a move, why wouldn't they do that? So the combination of, well, they don't want a guy like Uribe. They don't want to get nothing and just save a couple of bucks. Well, then what are we doing here? How are we improving the team? If we're only doing it if somebody gives us a top prospect for Dylan G, is that our MO? We're not going to take some salary relief or a useful player who's an upgrade to our current roster? Neither one of those works, Mike?
Yeah, it's been a frustration of mine for a long time. It just appears to me that the current front office refuses to make a move unless they feel it's overwhelmingly in their favor. When you try to discuss that on a transaction-by-transaction basis with people, they go, what's wrong with that? You know, like, and then they point to some of the transactions. The San Diego has not made, from a trading standpoint, right, many transactions where we would look at them now and go, he got, you know, ripped off.
Right.
But it seems for me to lead to such a dearth of transactions that the sum is not adding up to what you need. You need to put a team on the field. You need to actually put a team that goes over 500 5 years into your reign.
Well,
who
and
cares that 3 years ago you won a trade? I mean, at some point, how about a trade that helps both teams? That's okay.
Well, look,
you don't have to win the deal.
The dearth of transactions, to your point, leads to Eric Campbell getting a bunch
right.
of starts.
Right.
You know,
right.
it is crazy.
Danny Munoz.
Right. Exactly. All right, Mike, let's move on. I think we're running towards the end. We only have a few minutes left. And I did want to talk about the Met of the Week because I know you wanted to have a few words about this. Based on what we said at the top of the show, I think we want to have co-Mets of the Week, unfortunately, because both of them, you know, have passed away. We mentioned Darrell Hamilton earlier and Nelson Doubleday. And I know there were a few things about Nelson Doubleday that you wanted to make sure that we covered, Mike. Why don't you go through them?
Yeah, you know, Nelson Doubleday to me, and can we... so happy about Doubleday. I felt like he sort of released the franchise to me. There was...
Because of the D-Rolay era, Mike?
Yeah, because he was known, and you brought it up already, and yes, you know, that was a very famous moment that by all accounts he stepped in on the Piazza situation, and really one of his last, I would say, aggressive acts as he was starting to be, you know, become more of a partner in the situation than a leader. He insisted on Mike, and, you know, I've listed the Piazza trade, in my opinion, as the greatest trade in team history because of what Piazza meant for the franchise. So if that's the only thing that Doubleday had that he was involved in, that would cement his place to me in Met history as like this, you know, great figure. But I always think back to, you know, 1979 and then 1980 when Doubleday came in. This franchise was in such a mess with the M. Donald Grant, C-Relay situation. There was no light at the end of the tunnel. And it was just so obvious from the day he bought the franchise. I mean, he had 88% of the franchise, but he bought it, the Doubleday Publishing Unit. They immediately started to put money into the team, money into the organization. It was just, it might have been 1984 before it turned around on the field, but it was just so obvious to me from 1980 on. You know, you started to see players show up. He hired Cashin. It was pretty obvious right away that he knew what he was doing. And this all started with Doubleday, you know, from Doubleday. You know, Doubleday buying the team. And I've always been indebted to him. I mean, his 1986 team, you know, there isn't many Met fans that don't speak, you know, in reverence about that team. And we see it right now. I mean, it all starts with a commitment from ownership, and he was a committed owner. And we went from horrible, fantastic, you know, from in the beginning of his time with the team. I don't think that was an accident. I think he was he did the right things as an owner to make that all happen. And I'll always be appreciative. I was sad to see his passing. And then one quick last thing, because I also want to give a shout out for him. You know, I'm a big, you know, music guy. And in 1980, he bought a radio station. I believe it's the one that's now Q104.3. And he named it WAPP and made it a rock station and gave everyone in New York, including me, a commercial-free summer. That was the first thing he did when he bought that radio station. So yeah, he also gave me a whole summer of music with no commercials. So happy about
that.
Didn't know
that. But
I like
that.
Cool. Yeah, that was pretty cool. Let me tell you.
Can you quickly? We only have a couple of minutes. I don't remember exactly, and I try not to pay attention, frankly, to some of this stuff. But the how did it happen that the Wilpons kind of wrestled control? Did Nelson just have enough of fighting with them?
There was a couple of things that happened. The first thing is there was a clause in the original deal when they bought the team in the early 80s that if it ever changed hands, whatever the price would be on the changing of hands, Fred would have the ability to up his stake to 50%. He had a right of first refusal. What happened was the Doubleday bought the team originally, not with his personal money. He bought it with, it was part of Doubleday Publishing. And he wanted to transfer it to his personal, you know, he wanted to buy out the publishing company and own it personally. And Wilpon was able to show that meant it was changing hands and was able to get it 50%. From that day forward, because, you know, 50-50, if you don't have the right two people, it's just,
right. There's
always going to be that. Eventually, when Doubleday decided he'd had enough, and I think he wasn't getting any younger, Wilpon wanted to buy him out, and there was a very big battle between the two, the proper price. And Bud Selig, and we kind of know the whole Bud Selig Wilpon thing is, you know, there's a lot there that we might not be real great. You know, he set like a price that was, as far as Doubleday was concerned, way lower than market value. I think like $350 million, and this was 2002. So think about it.
Right.
And you know, so Fred was able to buy. Fred didn't have to spend a lot of money to get this team, and Nelson was really mad about that because, you know, rich guys don't like not just all this money.
I don't
blame
him.
But in the end, that was a fight between a bunch. Yeah, that was a fight between a bunch of rich guys. I mean, there's no other way to put that. But when I think about him, I think back to those 80s, and he was very visible in those 80s too. He really was, and and again, commercial free rock and roll. So I hope he's rock and rolling up there right now.
That's great, Mike.
Middle of the week.
All right, so that's great, Mike, and thanks for that perspective. That about wraps it up. We had this is, again, we talked about it before. We had tons of things we didn't even get to cover. But the good news is we're going to be back relatively quick next week. You know, again, we try to tie up with the Mets schedule. Next Thursday, July 2nd, the Mets have a day game, so we'll come back with our next episode next Thursday night. We'd like to thank Artie for calling in. And again, our weekly prediction right before we go off, Mike. Mike, when we speak on July 2nd, will the Mets are a game and a half out. Will they be closer or further from first place than they are today?
Oh, you don't want to know the answer to that.
Okay, we'll leave that out then. Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Mike, and we will talk to everybody again next week, and let's go, Mets.